changed.
Kind of what we're going to talk about, what I'm going to talk about here, I guess if I use the mic, is some of the questions they had a few decades ago. There's been a lot of advances in the last many decades, but there, I think there's still some things we need to look at. I want to mention, first of all, the review paper by Taylor and Klepper in 1978, The Role of Rooting Characteristics in the Supply of Water to Plants. At that time, there was a big interest in root length density over time, axial resistance, radial resistance, especially related to shrinkage and poor contact. And the big problem they had at that time was they did not have very good tools for monitoring the soil environment at a very short time scale. They were concerned about old roots were superized and maybe they didn't function. And the heterogeneity in the soil, not just the water, but the density, the temperature. There was a review by Passier where he was mentioning the fact that if you have roots growing in biopores and fractures, they can penetrate rapidly through great depth in the soil. However, they don't have very good contact with the soil because they're along these head faces and fracture faces, so the poor contact. So you have, but if they don't have those pathways, they don't penetrate very well. But there's better contact. A recent review looked at some different ways of handling models to look at this heterogeneity of the roots, not only the branching but how they're growing around structures and in the voids. I just have to mention this in passing, that we have to realize, of course, when we're talking about root systems, we have nodal root systems and we have tap root systems. In this case of the corn, the laterals off the nodal roots are very numerous, but they're rather large diameter. This is a part of a soybean root system where we have the tap root with secondary thickening. And many, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth order lateral roots, but they're much finer and there's not near as many of them. Okay, I want to briefly mention, when considering how roots and soil interact, how roots are growing through structured soil. The picture here, we have the many fine aggregates, and maybe it's a tilled soil or something, where the roots shove the aggregates out of their way. These are loose aggregates that are not stuck together. However, if the roots encounter larger aggregates, they tend to be deflected around the aggregates, and even larger peds, they tend to be deflected. I have on the back a list of more detailed on these references, but many people have studied this, and basically when you have roots growing in structured soil, in addition to the root cap stuff that was mentioned earlier, the root hairs are said to anchor the roots so they have greater pushing power. If you've got the fine aggregates that are not fixed, the roots can shove the aggregates out of the way, but as the aggregate gets larger, unless there's a plane of weakness or a little hole within the aggregate, the roots are pretty much stuck going around it. Especially, we're talking about in the subsoil where the aggregates are more fixed or incompletely fragmented, you can't really move the aggregates very well. So the roots are going to be deflected. And several of these have looked at that deflection seems to induce a hormonal response, which causes the roots to thicken and to have more branching. Now, you can sometimes get roots into some of the larger peds if there's some pore, maybe some finer roots can get in the pores, or if there's some plane of weakness, the roots might be able to get through. But again, as we mentioned before, having these fractures in the soil allows the root to penetrate into the subsoil, and even if there's not real good contact and they're not evenly distributed, sometimes it's better to have some roots in the subsoil to at least use some of that water. But again, the roots tend to be flattened along the fracture phase. Okay, this is a corn plant, and it was just grown for a little over a week in aggregates that were greater than 8 millimeters diameter. This corn plant was grown in aggregates less than 2 millimeter diameter. In this case, I don't really have the whole root system because once they got to the edge of the pot, they weren't influenced by the aggregates so much. The thing you notice about this one with the 8 millimeter aggregates is the roots tend to be kind of wavy. That's the deflection. Also notice that these roots are thicker than the roots in the fine aggregates, and there's more branching. Again, that's what we mentioned. This was a study that I went through and found Omoto and Ritchie, where they were instead of little tiny 8-millimeter aggregates, they're talking about PEDs, and they call them small and large. But the small was 6 to 10 centimeters, and the large was 14 to 18 centimeters diameter. It didn't make any difference what size the PEDs were. The roots were growing in the fine soil between the PEDs, and very little of the roots were actually growing into the PEDs, and perhaps that was mainly just in the planes of weakness and the pores within the PEDs. I don't show it here, but in their study, they also had some TDR within the PEDs from the edge to various points out to the center to the edge, and there was a water content gradient. The more water in the center of the PED and drier at the edge, which is what we'd expect. Again, showing that when you have these roots clustered around those PEDs, you don't get a uniform extraction, but it may be better to at least have some planes of weakness around the PEDs to allow the roots to enter the subsoil. This was data from a study that I had done many years ago where we purposely compacted a soil, and the zone of deepest compaction was at 35 centimeter. And this was also where almost two-thirds of the roots were in distinct fractures or in biopores that were bigger than the root. And I mentioned that sometimes a root could grow in a biopore the same size, but you can't tell by mapping if the root formed that pore or if it was already there. Just showing that when the soil gets denser, the roots are very much restricted to these biopores and fractures. This was a very interesting study, Williams and Weil. They had various species, including canola and also some radishes and things, where they were growing in the winter and early spring. This is a climate where they could actually do that, where it was wet. And when the soil was wet, these roots formed channels through the wet soil because wet soil has lower impedance. Then the next year, the next summer, when it was dry, there was a drought, the soybean roots were following those same canola channels that had been there. This was one of these many, many rhizotron studies they had in the past. I know there's a lot of words there. I couldn't figure out a good way to synthesize this. I've been really interested in how roots maintain pores and fractures just by the fact that they're growing in them. There does seem to be some indication that the root activity when the fruit rewetting and drying can break down some larger PEDs, and that was just one study. There were several others. But then when the roots are present, you actually have less shrinkage in those large PEDs and those large fractures because the roots tend to anchor the soil more. I thought that was rather interesting. You know, there was some idea of these pioneer species that can penetrate the dense soil and let other species follow. And I read through, these are just a couple, I read through about six or seven papers, and in every case when roots could penetrate soil, it was wet. The wetness reduced the impedance. In many cases they were sodic soils, but not every case. Some of the pioneer species had parenchyma, which allowed them to penetrate the wet soil. There's a lot of factors you have to consider, not just compaction, but temperature. Wet soils may be too cool for roots. But there are some species who can penetrate soil that might be too dense when it's dry, but they only do that because it's wet when they grow through it. The roots do not pierce their way through dense, dry soil unless they're growing along PED faces, at least from the studies I could read. You think about root channels can be a preferential pathway, but if the root is in a channel the same size as the root, it's plugging that channel, and that channel is not going to function for preferential flow or bypass flow until the root dies, or if the root is in a biopore bigger than the root or a channel bigger than the root. And then you can have the preferential flow around the root or where the root had been before it died. And preferential flow meaning that you've got solutes in your incoming water and rapidly leaching to deeper depths, or bypass flow where your solutes are in your soil matrix and the water rushes around them. You may actually have less leakage. Now, you know, we all know about rhizosphere effects, but what's a rhizosphere effect if the roots are concentrated on these PED faces? You're getting a lot of organic material, root exudates, old roots sloughed off, in localized zones along these PED faces. And that's changing the wall properties. And Clothier et al. Had studies suggested that you're developing localized marginal hydrophobicity, which is affecting the water patterns and the wettability. And you maybe get some uneven wetting because of these patterns along the pore walls. And others have studied a lot of the new aggregates formed around roots. So how can you really look at this clustered root when you're considering how roots interact with the soil. This was one of the papers, Bruckler, and they have several papers after this. They basically took a map, a two-dimensional horizontal map. Each dot is a root that they encountered in that horizontal face. Obviously, the roots here are competing better than the roots out here for nutrients and water. And so they did these tessellation approach and then to look at this. And this was just one way, and then they take those series of two-dimensional planes and develop into a three-dimensional model. And I think this is sort of like an intermediate approach. The other approach is to look at each root, you know, microscale root model, each root and each branch and the soil conditions that are encountered. However, that may take more memory than what you have, and this is sort of an intermediate approach where you can allow for a root system that's not homogeneously distributed. Another important component is that the root function, many have shown this from studies looking at compacted on one side and not the other, or temperature effects. But here I'm considering water, that when roots are concentrated, they're concentrated where the conditions are most favorable. And if the surface is dried out and there's water underneath, the roots will grow more where there's the water. It interacts with the temperature because as it dries out, it gets warmer and the roots can grow better when it's warmer. This was a study, from my PhD work. There had been a few weeks without rain. This was tensiometer data. This was after a few weeks without rain where everything above, about 45 centimeters, was out of the tensiometer range. It was so dry. And the bulk of roots, there had been some roots near the surface and then about 35 centimeters, and then 2 weeks later they concentrated maybe about 50 centimeters. Again, showing that the roots will grow where the conditions are favorable. The reason I mention this is when we get to some of the bigger scale root models, they usually assume that we have an exponential decline of root function with depth based on root mass, and they don't consider that root mass doesn't really correlate with root function. This was a more extreme example. I really like this study, even though it was from 1972, Rakowski. They had a column of soil. They were growing soybean, and they had a water table maintained at 1 meter depth. They did not water it at all. So the only water available was from that water table. And progressively, as they dried down, the bulk of the root function, and this sink term, this was a real popular type of calculation that was done in the 70s, the sink term. The bulk of the root water uptake after 59 days was about 55 centimeters, and then after 73 days was down to about 65 centimeters. Again, showing that roots can and do grow where the conditions are favorable. This is yet another study. This was a field study. This was corn. We'd had 2 weeks. This was starting from like mid-June up until about the early beginning part of the second week of July. It had rained on day 173. The first week, see those little open triangles, which is a week later, most of the water was taken up in the upper 30 centimeters. After that first week, there wasn't much more water taken there. Now the water is primarily taken up from 30 to 90 centimeters. And the water table dropped during this two-week time. Was from about 85 centimeters down to below 120 centimeters. In addition, we calculated that there was water moving up from the water table into the root zone about a total during that two-week time of about 9 millimeters. So there's a lot of water that can be used deeper than the top surface depth. Now this is a exposed horizontal face in the subsoil showing the roots growing in the fractures. Now if you have those roots concentrated in the fractures, what does that mean when the water, you get preferential flow and you get water flushing down those fractures? There's often been this idea that water that drains is not available to roots. I say the water doesn't drain because some of the water doesn't drain because the roots use it. There's less energy to take up the water in those big pores than in the small pores. And there's no reason that once there's enough evaporative demand that roots can't use the water that's right there where they're at. And in fact, the studies, like even these old studies, Wilcox, they had a study where definitely the drainage ceased more rapidly when you had roots present. And they said the roots were intercepting that water that was draining. this isn't completely the same thing, but I was just looking at, this was in that same year, the same corn, looking at different rain events and how fast the water table peaked and then started to decline. There's several factors. There's lateral flow and all these other things going on. But during the season, June, July, August, and September, when the roots were growing, the water table peaked either during the rain or just a few hours later. In October, when the roots had senesced, the water table peaked up to a day later. In other words, it continued to rise because there were not the roots to intercept that water. Several studies have examined row-inter-row effects. I mentioned things like compaction on one side and not the other. You have residue effects on temperature and on water. If it gets dry at the surface, the roots can use the water deeper, depending on the temperature. Stem flow, you don't get stem flow as much on the soybean, but the corn plant, the funnel shape, tends to get more water where the roots are at. In the same corn study in 2007, there were different rain events. There was more water increase in the row than in the inter-row. Looking at times between rains, anything more than a couple days, there was more water loss from the row than from the inner row because there's more roots there, there's more water there. And I did look a little bit at some of the lateral redistribution, and there's a small amount, usually less than a millimeter, that redistributes from the row to the inner row, but most of this actually seemed to be greater water loss. Soybean doesn't have the same funneling shape of the plant, and so it's not near as consistent a trend, either for water increase or for water decrease between rains. So I really am encouraged by some of the studies, especially some of the root imaging studies, where they've looked at soil root gaps, root hair function, compensatory functions where the roots are growing where and functioning better where the conditions are more favorable. This study that Garrigues, they actually, it was a root imaging study of some whole root systems, and they showed the water uptake and how it over time it went deeper and deeper and from into the soil. Things like root turnover, which have been studied in many rhizotrons. This row inter row I mentioned, clustered root effects because of the roots clustered in these biopores and fractures. A lot of work in trees on this hydraulic lift through the plant, where the water moves through the plant and then is exuded more near the surface. This can happen probably in species other than trees, although I've only seen lab studies related to like cotton or alfalfa. Mainly dicots because of the vascular tissue. Some studies they consider that over time, especially in corn, some of the yield improvement was just because they inadvertently bred corn roots to grow more vertically and less horizontally and use the water more efficiently. There was one study with some, you know, the difference between the macroscopic and the microscopic scale models. The macroscopic looks at the whole root system, whereas the microscopic looks at the root by root function. So sometimes if you don't have enough computer memory to look at each root and you want to look at the whole root system, but you still need to look at these roots are clustered. One way to look at the variation in water uptake, this is De Jong, they actually had a model where by different depths they could have the root function where the water where the water content was greatest. This is just one of the many rhizotron studies showing root turnover of alfalfa being a perennial. You know, some of the roots die back and grow back the next year. Some of the areas I'd like to see more work on in the future, I would like to really answer how much water in the macropores the roots can use, and water and whatever's in the water, versus the use in the matrix where it's got to flow to the roots since the roots are mainly in the macropores. I'm really excited about it. I don't do the root imaging studies. A lot of people have. However, it seems like most of the root imaging studies to date have been on sand or glass beads, which really is good, but ultimately we need to get to some kind of structured media. And I just want to challenge you, those of you who do these root imaging studies, can you think of a way to make an aggregate, maybe out of silica flour or something? I don't know. In compensatory water uptake versus root age variation, I wonder if it's just that, not that roots are too old to take up water, but that the water's already gone, so the younger roots are where the new water is. And then maybe if you rewire them, these older roots can function again. You know, not the ones with secondary thickening, but the other roots, a little bit old. And water table effect. Two studies mentioned it. I think we need to consider that in our studies. So.
Very good. Someone might turn the lights on in the back, just because the button's lit up there. This switch is right by the door. Any questions? For Sally? I have one question for you. When you had that, the corn had the, you showed this corn seedling with the roots, right, and the thickened root. Did you notice much difference in the surface, in a difference in sizes in the shoot part of it?
Well, you could see a little bit of that curvature just until it got out of the soil, yeah.
But was one shoot seem larger than the other? In other words, where there is a difference in partition of carbon between the top and the bottom?
We didn't actually calculate that. I do have to apologize. I have to leave for a meeting, but I left some notes in the back.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Sally.
Yeah.
Our next speaker is Dr. Joe Benjamin, who's with the USDA ARS and at the Great Plains Research Center in Akron, Ohio.
And Colorado.
Akron, Colorado. Well, I'm really quick.
There is an Akron, Colorado.
I'm on over.
And I will show you where Akron, Colorado is.
I am on automatic pilot.
You are on automatic pilot.
And I know I've known Joe for many years. I should know that.
Uh-oh.